Gary Buxton. Is there any questions anybody wants to ask now? We have these papers up here. Maybe at the next break, if you have a question that occurs to you. Yeah, you got a question? That's it.
Okay,
that's it. If we get to a fifth edition, I guess there would be some inference with that.
Right.
We got a fifth. We're not there yet. About every 20 years, so you got a little ways to wait. Any others? How many of you are somebody's kid? How many of you have kids? How many of you have grandkids? I don't know what your chances are. I'm married to a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. We have a daughter that's 16, and she has all the makings. I mean all the makings, and some makings we didn't even know were part of it. I have an interest in making amends to two children that are much older, 141, 139, from my first marriage. I have an interest in two granddaughters by my daughter, who are showing all the signs of being normal, thank God, whatever that is. And I have a grandson and a granddaughter by my son. And they're pretty early in the game, so it's hard to know. I owed amends to my kids. How many of you did too? I've made the direct amends that I can make. But the best amend I can make to my kids, my grandkids, your kids, and your grandkids, is to make sure that if it becomes necessary for them to come to Alcoholics Anonymous, that there be an Alcoholics Anonymous for them to come to. Not something else. Not some watered-down, diluted, perverted version of what, at one time, might have been considered one of the greatest social movements in the history of mankind. The idea of two people with common experience coming together under some umbrella of protection from one another and from society, where all truth can be shared and nobody is accountable to the rest of society for having received that truth. We are in exalted status, those of us that have had the privilege to receive fifth steps from other people. Things are shared in there, oftentimes, that are criminal. They are abhorrent acts of people, but we deal with them in stride every day. Every day. If those people do not have a place that is safe, neutral, and protected with which they can engage in their disclosures, we have failed. I'm not held by any morality, by anybody else's code of conduct, certainly not by my own morality, when I am receiving somebody else's life story. I hope that Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't get so full of itself that it decides that we have obligations to society that trump the spiritual truth that comes out of a fifth step. And I say that with all the candor that I know how to say it with, and I recognize there are horrible things that happen to people. Horrible things. You all right back there? I'm sorry, I didn't mean to draw attention to you. I just didn't want you dying here. Oh, that never helps. You all right, honey? All right. My obligation to society, to my family, is to maintain the chairs of Alcoholics Anonymous wide open and that, in truth, I will never be able to help my own children. So I'll make you all a deal right now. Where I'm at, there will be AA, as long as I'm on the right side of the dirt. There will be AA. Please, dear God, where you're at, make sure there's an AA for my kids. Okay? I'll help your kids, you help mine. If the day comes. That's the deal. That's the level that Bill contemplated when he started thinking about the 12 concepts for world service. 1938, September. Alcoholics Anonymous formed a deal called the Alcoholic Foundation. The foundation was an incorporated trusteeship in New York. Their purpose was single: to maintain all these millions of dollars we were going to get by selling that first printing of the big book. Very simply put. And I'm not going to kid anybody in here. The book was written primarily as a money-raising endeavor. It was also our first effort at public information, of opening our doors to the public and letting them know what we were, what we aren't, what we do, and what we don't do. The first time we ever had anything out there like that. That's the big book. I read nearly everything that there is to be written about alcoholism from anybody. And I do not trust me, do not take my word for it, but I'm going to share with you that it is to this date the best description I have ever read of active alcoholism, and more importantly, what is possible if one takes these actions of change. I will guarantee you that if you'll take this thing whole, your odds are better than 50-50, and that's the best game in town, period. Nobody else gets even close to those kinds of numbers. Okay? But Bill was thinking about all this stuff. This Alcoholic Foundation got loose. It was populated mainly by Rockefeller people. Yes, the Rockefeller Standard Oil Group did not give us any significant amount of money. I think $5,000 at that dinner. But they put their hooks into us seven other ways. They used to be called the Octopus. And the reason was they had eight ways to get to you. Standard Oil at one time owned 80% of the production of oil and gas in the world and 100% of the retail market. It was a monopoly, and it was a controlling monopoly. John D. Rockefeller was not a free enterprise guy. Okay? He believed in monopolies and trusts as being a way to keep the price down. But it got away from him. Rockefeller also was one of the oldest guys to introduce the idea of philanthropy. You spend your whole life building up this fortune, and then you spend generation after generation doling it out. And so Alcoholics Anonymous was just among hundreds of petitioners who asked for what? Money. Bill was convinced that's the only way we were going to make it. We had to get hospitals, we had to get paid 12-step workers, we had to get education deals, financial lending to newcomers. He was convinced that's what we had to do. They just need some money, get them on their feet. How many of you have heard a newcomer say that? Hey, better yet, as a newcomer, how many of you said that? Yeah. Absolutely. So already by 1942, Bill's sideways with the board. They're fighting all the time. At that time, we had four non-alcoholics, three alcoholics that were on the foundation board. A guy named Ed Webster in 1942 came to Bill and said, I've written a book. I'd like to see if Works Publishing, who then was publishing our big book, would be interested in publishing this. Bill read it. He thought it was very interesting, good book. He said, I'll take it to the board. So he did. The foundation said, no. Bill, leave it alone. We're selling 5,000-6,000 copies of the big book every year, $3.50 a pop, 7-day money-back guarantee. We're not getting that many back. They must be getting a tremendous result as a result of this. Just leave it alone. Follow the book. Don't bring us any more of these submittals. Bill took the book back to Ed Webster and said, Ed, I just was not successful in getting the board to take this on. I suggest you take it to another publishing house and get this book produced. I think it would be helpful. Ed took the book to a number of places. Finally, he was able to get it published. Today, that book is known as the Little Red Book. It was published at first by Collier's, I think, and then Hazelden. It was the first book that Hazelden published in a much revised form from its original text. It's been edited four or five times over the years. A lot of people are still strong proponents of that book. In 1948, Bill had already penned the 12 traditions in the Great Mind articles and sent them out basically to the General Fellowship. He began to think of this idea of how am I going to get this fellowship away from this board that I basically created. Why? The board at that time did not want to have any relationship with the groups whatsoever. It did not want to have a general service office, which by this time was clearing hundreds of letters a month coming in from all over. They didn't want to support that. All they wanted to do, these were Rockefeller people. Follow the money. Follow the money. Get that big book out. Sell that book. And our foundation, our general service office for the first few years, was supported almost entirely from book sales. Almost entirely. And Bill could see this was a train wreck about to happen. He couldn't get anything done in terms of finding a way for the fellowship to take care of itself so that it would be here in the future. Thus began the philosophical argument. The philosophy was, is this thing better left in a foundation who's going to build up a big wad of money and then perpetuate itself? The trustees were self-appointed. There was no election process. There was no third legacy. There was no group conscience. The alcoholics had no input into this whatsoever. We were led blindly by people that had no relationship with the groups. The alcoholic trustees came out of two groups, one in Lower Manhattan and the other in Connecticut. These were highbrow groups. They used to call them silk stocking groups. You had to have six figures of net worth to even get in. There were requirements for membership other than the desire to stop drinking. Remember, the traditions hadn't been adopted. They were just out there. The 1950 International Convention in Cleveland came along. We didn't know who could vote. We had no structure. We had no hierarchy of leadership. We had no real organization. Alcoholics Anonymous was enigmatic. It was just out there. Nobody really knew what it was. A lot of people still thought it was a cult. He put forward two proposals. One, and everybody in the room got a vote. He said, I move for adoption the 12 points of AA tradition to ensure our future. Seeing no objection, I move they be adopted. And everybody started clapping, and nobody knew what they were clapping about. But they, go Bill, good way to go, buddy. And the second piece was, I would like to start a general service conference on a five-year experimental basis, beginning in 1951, April in New York. We're going to bring delegates in from all of the U.S. and Canada, and they're going to begin to administer the overall public relations policy for AA and take care of literature needs and other things. Now, seeing no objection, I move it be adopted. Hey, everybody! What are we clapping for? Well, we're not real sure, but Bill said it's got to be good. And thus began what we today call our General Service Conference. You, as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, have a voice in that process. You have a voice through a trusted servant, the idea of which first is presented in the ninth tradition long form, and then again presented in the short form of the second tradition, which is actually longer than the long form of the second tradition. But that's just neither here nor there. Our leaders are the trusted servants. This was a novel idea. Nobody had ever tried anything like this. And what it was somebody was going to be entrusted by the group, by a collection of groups, to go take care of matters greatly affecting AA as a whole. Why? So that the groups did not get distracted by all the noise. And they were going to be able to focus on what? Carrying its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. So we created this delegated authority to let these people take care of the business for us. Implicit in that is we said, we trust you. I was kicked out of the Scouts at 12. I'm not trustworthy. I was drinking on a camp out. It didn't say you couldn't do it in the manual, which I memorized, just looking for the loopholes. And so I'm not trustworthy by nature. And I managed to improve on that lack of trustworthiness as time went by. So when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, by some bizarre set of circumstances, at 2 weeks of sobriety, they trusted me to make coffee for them. Oh, that was not good. At 6-7 months of sobriety, they trusted me to be their secretary treasurer. I was given money. That's a bad thing. And so I went down to the mailbox one morning, opened it up, and there was a check from an estate for $10,000 payable to our group, which at that time had $126 in the bank. After I figured out I could not convert this for my own personal use, you do what you do. I took it to my sponsor. And he looked at it and he said, this is a bigger deal than you and I can solve. We've got to take it to the group. So we took it to the group. And it took 3 business meetings for them to decide what to do for it. The old timers wanted to set up a little retirement fund because they'd all been past ESRs, but they were ESRs when Eisenhower was president, for crying out loud. Then one of them asked a question. I don't think he was a member of AA. And they looked and they said, what do you mean? Well, he hadn't been to a meeting in years. Since when was it a requirement to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous that you had to go to meetings? Where did that come from? So they took issue with that and they knocked that around for about 2 hours. This is 8 people. Come on. Nobody could remember who he was, where he came from, and these guys had been there since the foundation of that group. I don't know whether it was deliberately they didn't want to remember. They wanted the money. But we can't take the money unless we're absolutely sure that it's because somebody said we could have it who is a member of AA. That's the restriction. We can take no outside funds. None. At the end of the 3rd meeting, they came to a group conscience. 2nd tradition. The group conscience basically said, Gary, send the check back with a note of thanks. Tell them we can't accept the money. Oh my God, half of them had the big one. Just, oh God! All their dreams of the retirement fund went out the window. So I sent the letter back, and about a week after that, I got a phone call from the lawyer. He said, I've been practicing law for 38 years, and I have never had a check come back, ever. What do you suggest I do with it? I said, we have no opinion on outside issues. Yeah. And this is an outside issue. You'll have to do your best. They ended up giving it to United Way, which is fine with us. We didn't care one way or the other. But I saw in that exercise, I saw every one of the traditions come to life in my mind. I mean, it was all there. It was one of the best things that ever happened to that group. It brought us closer together. Yes, we were still divided on the opinion. Yes, we were still divided on the outcome. but we trusted the process by which we came to a decision. The concept in its simplest form, folks, takes the group conscience and the ninth tradition to the street. It puts it into play. It makes it a practical exercise. When we're asking somebody to be a GSR and they ask the question, what am I supposed to do? The answer is not nothing. The answer is not, don't worry about it. The answer is, here's what we ask you to do. We're asking you to go to take care of stuff that if we had to take care of it as a group would distract us from what we're trying to get done here. If you go take care of that business, come back and tell us what you've done, and we'll have your back. They trusted me and others that have had that position to go do that for them. So there's a lot to this. Maybe sometimes for the first time in our lives, we're being asked by people to be trusted. That's why it's critically important that if this avenue presents itself to you, do not say no. Evidence your trustworthiness by fulfilling the duties. Fulfill the duties. And you will grow as a result of that. Will it suck? Yes. Have you been to a district meeting lately? Oh my God, it's like watching paint dry. We wonder where patience and tolerance comes from. It comes from practical exercises just like that. And I got to tell you, folks, if you belong to a group that does not afford members of that group to participate in AA at all levels, it's a damn poor group. And if you're not willing as a group to support them financially so that they can do it, so the rich mucky mucks aren't the only ones that are doing it. The guy that's at the bottom of the shelf, he just came off a bad ripple drunk. That guy has the same, or gal, has the same opportunity as the one that's got all the money and is buying the pot every night. Okay? We never want to put conditions on the quality of service. If the guy on the lowest rung on the totem pole is the one that could deal the best service, then our group, by God, has a responsibility. And that is to help them do the job. One of my sponsees, a guy I've sponsored for over 25 years now, when he first started out in AA, they asked him to be the GSR. He was a single parent of a little girl who had some issues around some health stuff. And he said, I don't know how I can do it. I've got to take care of my daughter. A couple of the deacons in the group came up and put their arms around him and said, we'll help you, man. We'll help you. And so the group members took turns watching that little girl while he was off at assemblies. They gave him a little bit of money to go to these things. When we first started out, we were bunking 6-8 to a room. Males, females, we're all, it was just like a big old hippie commune in there. And everybody was on good behavior. We all wanted to be there, and we felt so grateful that we were part of that process. And we were able to participate and give our group's voice to the greater discussion. And we got over real quick the idea that we knew how it was going to turn out and that we had an investment in how it's going to turn out. Any of you made amends? Like even one or two? Or yeah, sorry about that. Fell in love with your neighbor's wife. Couldn't help it, you know. My disease kicked in. See, when you make amends, the best you can hope for is going into that amend, you're absolutely neutral as to outcome. You're there to sweep off your side of the street. You're there to clean up your nefarious activities best you can. How that turns out is out of your hands. Sometimes you are forgiven. Sometimes they have a new item to put on their own inventory. You never know how it's going to go. Most of them, honestly approached, succeed beyond our wildest dreams. We just took that ninth step and extended it right into the ninth tradition. Because whether you know it or not, when you take the lead on making an amend, you are becoming a leader. You're the one that's taking the initiative. You're going to sit around and wait for them to be contrite. You're going to have a long, it's going to be a long day in school. It is. You assume a leadership role. Many of us for the first time in our lives. And you make amends and suddenly you're a qualified leader in Alcoholics Anonymous. The personal adventures before, all the disastrous stories and the hierarchy there. When you have a guy comes to you and says, I've stolen $600 from the treasury and I want to make amends and I can give you $25 a week, will you accept my amends? That will do more for that guy and for that group than any other thing. The group has no choice but to forgive him. An AA group is a nothing out there. How are they going to sue him? Who's going to sign the complaint? Don't shove it off on the GSR. Nobody can. Nobody can. Your chances of being sued because you stole money from AA are slim to none. The group hopefully takes stock of itself and says, geez, we're sloppy with our treasury. We're just sloppy. You know, the guy's warm and breathing air. You're the treasurer. He never wrote a check in his life. Except when it was hot. And AA is a cash and carry outfit. Sometimes our treasurers do more carrying than cashing. Okay? It happens all the time. And it happens because the rest of the group fails to take responsibility for what goes on in the group. I know we have great laughs, great fun, humor, joke, carry on whenever it does happen. And it happens all the time. As you move down the food chain through the district and then the area and then on to the general service office and the conference, the numbers get huge. We have never had an alcoholic treasurer at the general service office. Jesus. So hanging back there always is this idea that we're not trustworthy. And we've drank the Kool-Aid on it, in my view, way too long. We have got some heavy hitters, financial hitters in Alcoholics Anonymous. And they, as a treasurer of the General Service Board, you are in charge of two funds. One of them is the Employees Retirement Fund. It's at about $15 million. And the other is the General Service Board Prudent Reserve. It's at about $15 million. Tremendous responsibility. In addition to that, you have to administer about $6 million a year in group contributions. You have to administer about $15, $16, $17 million in literature purchases. You also have to disperse money to make sure that our employees are paid a fair salary and that they are given economic opportunity. We ask for the best. We pay at about the middle of the range. And living in New York City is horribly expensive. Horribly expensive. We think we're doing these people favors. I ask you this question. Would you work with us professionally as an employee at the General Service Office, putting up with us day after day after day? What's this I hear about? And they don't, who are you? Excuse me. That's how we call. That's how we email. That's how we write. That's how we fax. There's this guy in Texas. I know. It's a big state, a lot of nuts. This guy has a stamp of the middle finger. And he stamps every one of his faxes and emails. It's just like out of control. So when I was a trustee, of course, they want the sheriff to take care of this. I remind him, I'm way down here. You guys are up here. He's one of you up here. Why don't you guys take care of it? We've tried everything. Would you sit down with him and talk with him? It was like talking to the piano. He wasn't going to change one little bit. I said, okay, well, I now have a picture of you. Cell phone's a great thing. So anytime anybody sees the bird stamp on one of the letters, I'll just text them a picture and they'll be able to associate the finger with the guy. I hope you didn't embellish your finger too much. You know, we embellish things, guys do. Sometimes I get on tracks that are just not appropriate, really. So, we've never had an alcoholic treasurer. I think it's probably time we have one. I really do. But in order to get that done, 21 people are going to have to, well, actually 17 are going to have to vote yes. And it's very difficult to get done. Actually, the non-alcoholics are in favor of it. They think it's time. I do too. A lot of our members don't. Still that fundamental distrust of one another. Still that fundamental isolation from one another. Still that idea that we've got something to hide back here. And I think if we want transparency at the office, the best thing we could do is get an alcoholic treasurer. Plus, let's don't forget, folks, these non-alcoholics, most of them serve us gratis. And it's getting harder and harder and harder to find non-alcoholics who are not only willing to help, but that are able to help. Everybody's most precious commodity in this room is time. Time, 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 time. It's the most precious commodity you and I have. And yet we contribute freely of our time, our labor, our effort, our love, our sacrifice in this activity that we do, this spiritual activity. And we don't put a price tag on it. We're asking non-alcoholics to have that same passion, verve, and vitality, and they don't have a dog in the hunt. You and I do. But they don't have a dog in the hunt. And I think we ask too much of our non-alcoholic trustees. The time commitment as a trustee on the General Service Board, they lie, tell you it's board weekend. You go in on Wednesday and come back on Tuesday. I think that's board week. Unless I miss the math, it's about 7 days, six. And we do that four times a year. We go for 10 days at a conference. We go, if I'm on the operating board, in 2006, I went to New York City 16 times from Denver. 16 times because of board meetings and etc. I went there one time because we got sued. Hey, you get sued about 50 times a year. Some of them are interesting. One of them was a bunch of inmates in a federal correctional facility who filed and obtained class action status for a $50 million lawsuit against AA. Their allegation was that we created electronic waves through our meeting that had affected their minds. Wow. And the judge signed off on it.
Of course.
Yeah. And even to the point where some of the members, these are self-declared members of AA, they went in with an aluminum foil hat on with some kind of pipe cleaner antennae so that they could ward off these things. And the lawsuit had pictures of this. It was like National Enquirer gone bad. I mean, Martian has baby, you know, that kind of thing. It was like, and the judge found, well, the suit was dismissed, obviously, but the point I'm trying to make is we had to spend $15,000-$20,000 of your contributions to defend ourselves in that suit. Okay? It's ridiculous what goes on. This particular lawsuit that I want to speak of is one of our area committees, which holds a state convention that combines three different areas together to have this state convention. How many of you have been to a convention, AA convention? Yeah, you know, most of us have been to at least one or two. Well, this guy that was appointed the chair from one of the areas had gotten a contract with, Holiday Inn Top Line Hotels. Anyway, and to do this convention. And then Brand X called him a couple of weeks later and said, we'll give you a better deal. So he went down, looked at their deal, liked it better, and signed a contract with them too. And the first contract, he just took, he didn't tell anybody. So this event happened. It was a big convention. About 8,000 people showed up. And the first hotel sued them. Sued the area committee of all three areas for $45,000 in liquidated damages. Because they blocked the hotel, did all the stuff, nobody showed up. Because these area committees had bought literature from GSO, a district judge decided that these groups were, or this area committees were subsidiaries of Alcoholics Anonymous World Services. And so they joined us in the suit. What do you want? Oh, excuse me. Where were they? Oh, they enjoined AAWS in the lawsuit. And so we were drug in. The state that was involved had a 10-day response time. The law firm that was handling it for us fumbled it. And so I was just getting in from New York 11 o'clock night on a Sunday, and I got the white paging telephone call to come back to New York City on the red eye, because I had to sign off on the complaint as chair of the board in original, and it had to be notarized in New York. So I just said, this is going to be ridiculous. Can you imagine a walk-up ticket to New York City from Denver? Well, I went to Spirit, and I'm not endorsing them. And they had a couple seats left, and they said, make us an offer. I said, $200. They said, done. Wrote it down, and I thought, well, that's nice going. But I didn't have any sleep in 2 days at that point. Got to New York, and I was beyond pissed. But I showed up at 9 o'clock to make sure I signed it, and then I turned right around and headed back. That's the kind of crap we run into all the time. The story had a nice ending. About 6 months later, I got a call from their corporate general counsel, who asked, he said, first of all, I want to tell you, we've dismissed the lawsuit, we paid off the hotel, everything's good as far as we're concerned. I'd like 10 minutes in front of your board to address them. I said, this is not a routine matter, I'll pull the board and see what they want to do. I did, and explained the circumstances, and they said, fine. So we gave this hotel chain 10 minutes of our time. They came in, there was a bunch of them, suit and tie types, came in and presented to us and basically said that, first of all, we feel very awkward in this situation. We have managed to sue Alcoholics Anonymous. That was never our intention. We liquidated the hotel. We made them whole. We just wanted to thank you for all the business that you're throwing our way. That in our hotel chain, 3,500 hotels, you are the largest single venue that we have, including the U.S. government. That for whatever reason, our hotels seem to suit you guys. And none of us know how to receive love. We're pretty good at giving it. But we don't know much about receiving love. Well, as a board, you can imagine. It was 11-fold. We can't receive it. We didn't know what to do with that. Somebody on the board pointed out that, you know, we don't endorse these activities. The fellowship does that. And that we're not connected to them in really in any way. We don't control it. We don't police it. There's nothing we really have to do with it. Fellowship just wants to have a party. They do. And they kind of looked at us, and we could tell clearly they knew nothing about what we did or how we did it. So we spent 8 minutes in explaining what we do. They came out of there and said, this shouldn't work. How can you not have a boss, a chief executive? How can you not have, like, huge sums of money in the bank? How come you don't borrow any money from financial institutions? You guys do this just by passing the hat? Pretty much. And some of our people don't put anything in. Oh my God, it was like it was brand new. They had no idea. What a neat experience to be able to be a part of that. And, you know, a couple of us were, And that's not humility at all. But it just shows me, even in this day and age, what a tremendous public relations job we still have to do out there. So many people know nothing about what we do. And from what I see, they're not beating the doors down to find out either. They're glad we do what we do. Oh, God, that's great. Glad you're doing it. Don't tell us about it. The reason Alcoholics Anonymous, and I hope one day Cocaine Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, and all of the Anonymouses become successful is because, for whatever reason, Alcoholics Anonymous has captured public opinion. They believe, the general public believes, that Alcoholics Anonymous works. And that's why their confidence is why we continue to get people. And no other reason. Yeah, we like to say alcoholism recruits them. Look, if we didn't have the confidence of the public, we wouldn't get any of them. Rational Recovery found that out. Okay? The other fellowships must step up to the plate and develop a sound public relations policy that will help them capture the public for that particular deal. For many years, we had a spokesperson who was unofficial. Her name was Ann Landers. And in her columns repeatedly, she would recommend that people go to AA, that the affected families would go to Al-Anon. And for years and years and years, people would say, I got here because of an editorial written by Ann Landers. When she passed away, nobody out there picked up the torch. So it's up to us as a fellowship. And we come up with rinky-dinky little public service announcements and trite stuff, little sayings, AA, it works, whoosh, you know. And it just, God, you know, we're horrible. And who comes here anyway? It used to be it'd come to and the test patterns would be on TV, you know. You know, the rockets were there and the planes fly over and then it was over till dawn. Not today, it runs 24/7, everywhere. We have very little in the way of presentation on that. The public relations that we do get today paint AA as the butt of every joke known to mankind. With the media, we have a terrible relationship right now. With the general public, our relationship is as strong as it's ever been, perhaps in some ways stronger. Let's capitalize on that, and let's trust the public for a change. That they don't view us as some kind of cult and some kind of ridiculous thing. Yes, I know, there's always the individual case. But as a collective whole, the public has tremendous confidence in Alcoholics Anonymous, its ability to capture alcoholics and to give them something. And for God's sake, when they get here, let's give them something besides, glad you're back, man, love you lots and whole bunches. Let's give them something a little better than that, shall we? Let's give them a message that has depth and weight. Let's take them on a trip through spiritual adventure. Let's show them what we did to get well. Let's do the things that the book admonishes us to do time and time and time again. And it's black on the white, and we can't hardly read it. We just can't get there. So the importance of a public relations policy is critical in this work that we do. Bill tried to foster that early on from the very beginning. He tried to cultivate relationships with the media. And to some degree was successful. Although certainly at the local level, the press was not always favorable to our cause. Alcoholism was not understood to be a disease basically until the 60s. Bill also cautioned us to stay out of the disease argument. It's a medically charged environment driven largely by politics within the AMA. Stay out of it. What do? We have a disease, man. Oh, really? Where did you obtain your doctor's diploma? From the mail? We're pronouncing people as having a disease. But I got to tell you, folks, right now, the AMA has got a committee convened. They've been convened for 7 years that I know of. They are a hung jury. They're divided 50-50 right down the middle, even with rotating people in and out. And it would not surprise me in my lifetime, and that's pretty limited at this point, that the AMA will not print a retraction paper on the disease concept. It would not surprise me. And my question to you is, where is AA going to be? More importantly, where are you going to be on this? We are affiliating ourselves with an outside issue. Medicine's view on alcoholism. Medicine's view on addiction. We better start using terms when we're dealing with people that are neutral medically. I have an allergy. That's probably not even really neutral. I have an illness. I have a malady, a spiritual malady. Those are the kinds of words when we're working one-on-one with people that we need to start thinking about using. We've got to get away from this. It's gonna hurt AA. It's gonna hurt our effectiveness. AA sometime after Bill died. All of Bill's writings up to the time he died cautioned us, admonished us. Stay out of it. It's not our deal. Shortly after he died, we began to see the word disease in the AA conference peer literature. I was on a committee in 2003 to rewrite the bylaws of the General Service Board. The word disease appears in there 16 times in the bylaws. It talks about a Class B trustee being one who suffers from the disease of alcoholism. I said, how did this get in here? Guess where? Non-alcoholics. It's the only way they can understand who's an alcoholic and who isn't. And we had to define it legally. And you're saying, what does that have to do with me? Everything. Because if the retraction statement comes, as I am concerned it may, we're going to be sitting there with our thumb up our proverbial you-know-what, and we're not going to have a leg to stand on in the eyes of the general public. Most of the public thinks that AA is behind the disease concept, when actually, it was a guy named Jelinek that first put it out there. And guess who Jelinek was? He was a non-alcoholic, and he was also a trustee on our board at the time we changed the bylaws. Not surprising how it happens. See, things to consider. We're at one. What's your pleasure? You want to take a few minutes? I can see the eyes are just, some of you are just really struggling here. And I get it. Yes, ma'am. Oh, Marty, yeah. Well, this is where Bill had to cut her loose, basically, and that's how the National Council on Alcoholism started. It was from one of our early members, Marty Mann, who sobered up in about 39, April, I believe. And Bill and Marty were trying to do some of this work through the foundation, the Alcoholic Foundation, and they quickly became apparent that AA cannot affiliate with any outside enterprise. So Bill and Marty formed the National Council on Alcoholism to provide education to the public about alcoholism. And that's when Marty took her AA hat off and put her National Council hat on and got loose out there and said AA, or alcoholism, basically is a disease. And it was through her efforts, together with the National Council, that persuaded the AMA in 48 to write the position paper that later became a part of their standard protocol for alcoholism. It is a disease that is treatable, it's not curable. Okay? And that was the position paper that came out in the 60s, or actually in the 50s, but it was before it was fully adopted, it was about 1962. Yes?
So, with that being said, how strongly did that influence following the
We have not changed the front matter of the text substantially since its first edition. So it didn't influence that at all. The Stoics, probably. Yeah. Yes?
I want to know, as far as AA and NA, I know that I'm an addict, and I go to a lot of AA meetings, but how do you guys feel about addicts coming to the meetings, or is it the same because it got the same steps, or do I need to just stay with Narcotics Anonymous, or am I welcome here? Because somebody told me that y'all was kind of stuck up. Y'all just want alcoholics in y'all group.
Yeah, as a member, you have to be an alcoholic in order to be a member.
But as me being an addict, like, I don't really like alcohol. Like, if they had alcohol, I wouldn't have to taste it. Like,
yeah.
Vapor alcohol, I could get high, I probably would have did it. But I don't like how alcohol tastes, you know? So, I mean, I'm at high risk for being an alcoholic, so that's why I still come, you know?
Anyone is welcome in an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Anyone. Closed meetings, you're probably going to have a tough time. Okay, there. We'll get into that.
Yeah.
What time is it? 1 o'clock?
5 after.
We'll get into that starting at about 2, so you've got to hang out till then anyway.
All right.
Anything else? Yes?
It sounds like the program, the focus is, you know, the workout program. You said in the book how you said in your speech the other day about working, those who work the program, they like to hear from people who work the program and work with others. It seems like the program is working the steps, clearing up your issues, and then helping someone else. All this other stuff is getting outside of that. It's breaking away from the program of AA, all this disease. That sounds like what you're...
The institutional aspect, the traditions, the concepts,
yeah,
the other two legacies.
Principle of working the program and helping others. It seems like you're bringing all this other stuff, it just distracts from the basic message.
The program of Alcoholics Anonymous is not linear. It's not linear. It is triangular. And the program of Alcoholics Anonymous consists of three parts. Just like our inventory consists of three parts. Three is a magic number in AA. Okay, what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like now. There's an example. Came to believe. There's another example. Three is a good number in AA. One is a better one, but three is good. Everything in AA comes in threes, twelves, and ones. So, they're integral, and that's going to be my attempt here, before I lose too many more of you, to try to show you how these dots connect. That's the purpose. So you're very astute at that. Yes. Yes.
Just a general thing, because I know a little bit about it, but not the whole story. What happened when we came to lose the circle, the triangle? Why didn't we fight it? Who was after us? I just hit the question.
I was a delegate when that happened, and we'll take that up right after the break.
Okay.
Hey, let's take 10, shall we? That would put us at about 120, give or take. Okay? I'll bring that up.
Thank you.